Okay, so today hopefully I will conclude, we'll conclude the discussion on stochastic planning with, of course, mostly we'll be focusing today on the factored representations, and which basically FF HOP is the paper that you read, and I also will talk a little bit about the other paper that I didn't require you to write a review on, but you know, we'll talk about it anyway. So last time we were talking about hindsight optimization for anticipatory planning and scheduling, which is where the FF HOP idea comes from essentially, where you are determinizing the future and then solving, determinizing the evolution of the future goals, and then that will give you a deterministic problem. You're trying to solve that problem and find out what is the best action to do based on that. Okay, and all FF HOP is doing essentially is, rather than deal with the exogenous uncertainty, whereas the uncertainty is in goals that are being created by somebody outside, it's dealing with the endogenous uncertainty. That means it's dealing with actions which have uncertain outcomes. Okay, and it's basically then to determinize the problem, basically what it needs to do is it has to sample the different realizations of an action. Okay, so if the domain has multiple actions, let's say there is A1 which basically says I will have effect E1 with probability 0.3 and E2 with probability 0.7, and then there is another action in the same domain, so this is E11, E12. This is E21 with probability 0.4, E22 with probability 0.6, let's say. Okay, then in essence, what you're doing is when I sample this, essentially, I mean the most general way of sampling this, of course, is you take a, you know, toss a coin here, and if it comes, it's a toss a coin which has a 0.3 heads and 0.7 tails probability. And if it comes heads, then you pick the action to be just this. If not, you would pick the action to be this. Okay. So, and in general, of course, when you have these kinds of numbers, these kinds of basically, remember we are using, this is the PSO operation, which is probabilistic strips operator representation, where the entire effect set here appears with 0.3. And entire effect set here appears with 0.7 probability. Okay, so the way normally you'll actually do, in fact, you could also have, here is a scenario where you can have another 0.4 E22, let's say, and then E23 with 0.2. That's also possible. Okay, so in this particular case, actually, you would be tossing a three-sided coin, essentially. Now, of course, we don't normally do that kind of a thing. So basically, the way you do the Monte Carlo simulation is you would pick a random number between 0 and 1. And based on what that random number is, let's say if my random number is 0.2, that means essentially I am here. If it's more than 0.3, that means I'm here. Okay? And one question, of course, is how many times do I pick these random numbers? I mean, the most general way is in trying to decide what realization this action will have, I will pick one random number here and then use that to decide what outcome it has. And then for here, I'll pick another random number. Okay, let's say for this one, I will pick a different random number. This one, let's say when I pick a random number, it turns out to be 0.81. If it's 0.81, then what does that mean? What is the outcome that this action has? It has a third outcome. I mean, you basically decide on one convention and stick to it. Okay. So if it is 0.81, that means the third side has come, because this is 0.4 side, this is another 0.4 side, and this is 0.2 side. Okay. So when you got 0.81, so in essence, think about it this way. Only if the random number you picked is in this 0.2 region would you say this outcome has happened. If it is in this 0.4 region, you would say this has happened. This 0.4 region, you will say this has happened. So these two are more likely than this. Yes?
What happens
if it's random? Like 0.3 for A1? What happens if it goes 0.3? Which one? For A1? Oh, so, you could decide whether it, you can either include it, you can make it a closed or open interval. Okay. So you can assume that it is 0 to 0.3 here, and then 0.3 plus to 0.7, 0.3 plus further. Okay. Okay. So the question, of course, is how many random numbers do I pick? If I pick one random number for each action, then in essence I have most general way of sampling the action outcome. Okay. And furthermore, we can also actually decide that, so one of the interesting things about stochastic planning, is suppose if I pick this action in the first step and it came this outcome, when I pick it in the second step, it doesn't have to come up with this outcome. It can come with this outcome next time. In fact, I mean, the remember, there's this saying which says that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different outcome. But in stochastic planning, that's not insanity, because you keep doing the same thing again and again until the right outcome occurs. Right? Okay, so for example, I keep tossing this coin until it comes heads. And essentially, for the first 1 million, there is a non-zero probability that for the first 1 million tosses, it will only come tails. Right? There's a non-zero probability of that happening. And I keep doing this, and eventually, I'll get a heads. Okay? So the point is that there are like two issues in sampling the actions. It was much simpler when we are sampling the goals that are coming out, because if I felt that the goals are coming from some distribution, I just basically sample the goals from that distribution directly. Here, I have to sample actions, and I have to decide whether I'm using the same number for all the actions or different random numbers for all the for different actions. Okay, that's point one. And point two is whether I am, even for the same action appearing in the first step versus second step versus third step, do I use the same random number or different random number? Okay. So based on your reading, what does FFHub do about these things?
Uses the
same
random number.
What? That's common random numbers, basically. So the action will have the same effect across all of these, and furthermore, in fact, they also have the same effect across the horizon too. That's another simplification you do. Okay. Normally, when I tell you think of a future, then you will assume in one particular domain, all these actions, this action will have E11 and this action will have E21. That's one domain. And with respect to that domain, you solve the problem. And a different sample, this might have 1-1 and this might have 2-2. You can solve the problem again with that domain. Okay. Now, if you actually want to support a domain where the actions have time-dependent effects, if you remember that if I basically say that I'm going to use a different random number for A1 appearing in the time step 1 versus time step 2, that means action A1 has time-dependent effect. If it is appearing in the first step, your random number might have said it will have this effect. If it's appearing in the second step, your random number generator might have said that it will have this effect. That's much more complex future. So it's a future with time-dependent effects. So there are two levels of simplification that FFhop does, you know, from the point of view of arbitrary sampling of futures. Okay, one, it makes the futures time independent, and two, it makes the futures correlated. That means the same random number is used for all the actions at the same level. Okay, and so there is some discussion as to how that kind of a sampling would bias the search. Okay, but that's the point about the common random numbers. How many what numbers are you using? Okay. Basically, what FFhop is trying to do is it essentially is trying to figure out what action should it do next. And it knows its current state, right? It's doing it online. So it knows its current state. And let's say it has actions A1, A2, A3. And A1 has some outcomes, A2 has some outcomes, A3 has some outcomes. Okay, so what it really needs to figure out is the Q value for each of these actions from this state. Okay, and it also does a certain look ahead. Basically, it's assuming that it's doing an H horizon look ahead. Okay, so in essence, it's trying to compute the Q value for each of these actions starting from this state up to a horizon H. Okay, and then whichever then has the highest Q value, you pick it. This is the basic idea. The only question, of course, is how to compute this Q value fast. Now, the definition of the Q value itself is quite simple, right? The Q of S AH is the reward of the current state S, okay, plus V star of S H minus 1. Okay, so the basically you would wind up needing, sorry, this is not right actually. This is not right. It's not the V star of S. Well, what?
Isn't it V star with
the next state? What? Exactly. That's so. The point, of course, is it. You know, when you're computing, and this is actually I need to fix this. When you do the action, you could go into multiple possible states. This particular action can take you to multiple possible states. You're taking the expected. You're basically taking the expectation over the values of all those states. Okay. So in fact, there should actually be a sigma and the probability. So on. Okay, but basically it's going to be in terms of the V star values of the action A neighbors of this state S. Okay, this state S, when you do action A, will get you to some other state. Those are its action A neighbors. And you need to know the V star values of those states, and you have the probabilities of getting to those states using this action, and you expected V star value is what comes out of that. Okay, so that's what you're trying to compute. And so basically what you need is the V star of horizon H minus 1. Okay, so now how do I compute the V star? You can actually compute this directly as a H horizon, finite horizon Markov addition process, and compute its policy. If you do that, actually you will at least get H horizon look ahead, H horizon look ahead, correct decisions. What hindsight optimization does is it doesn't actually do that. It does not compute the H horizon look ahead accurate policy. Instead, it simplifies the policy of horizon H itself. Okay. So what you do there is instead of computing V star directly, you compute V star by sampling. Okay. To sample that, basically you would generate a bunch of futures where the futures are, you know, essentially each future is a particular domain realization of the stochastic domain. So in the case of anticipatory scheduling, each future is a particular set of goals that you get asked to deal with. Okay? In this case, each future is a particular realization of actions and their outcomes. and as I said, in the most general case, actions can have different outcomes at a different horizon levels, different steps. Okay, so I would basically you consider a bunch of futures, and then where a future is a mapping of state action and time to a state. State action and time to a state. That's the most general description. Normally, an action is just a state action to state. But now it's state action time to state. It's a time-dependent future. Okay, but it's the good thing about it is it's deterministic. Even in the most general case, it is still deterministic. Okay, it's not a classical planning problem you ever solved, where basically the problem says based on the depth of the search tree, the action winds up having different children. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you actually have the most general future like this, then depending on the same action being used in the fourth level, it has S7 as the outcome. If it was used in the second level, it might have S3 as the outcome. Okay? Yes?
You're sampling based on some probability. Why this is deterministic?
No, but the sample itself is deterministic. All I'm saying is, after I pick the sample is deterministic.
Yeah, but because we are kind of predicting the future. So
yeah.
Is it 100% sure about the future?
No. All it's doing is, given the probabilities on the action outcomes, it's taking, let's say, 100 futures. Okay, and these 100 futures, the distribution of these futures is based on the original probabilities. But each future itself is a deterministic future. So the idea is that suppose tomorrow it can be sunny, cloudy, or rainy, right? And let's say this is 0.7, 0.3, 0.0. Okay. Now, I can now sample tomorrow. Okay. I will get, okay, it will be sunny, cloudy, sunny, cloudy, sunny, blah, blah, blah. So, if I do a huge number of these are the possible outcomes that can actually happen tomorrow. If I do, let's say, 1,000 of these with high probability, 700 of these will be sunny and 300 of those would be cloudy. But none of them would be rainy because rainy has zero. And if this one has, for example, if this was 2,9 and 0,1, then a very few of them would be rainy. But the point is, each of these are exact futures. They're exact samples of the future. Okay? So I could then decide based on, suppose I did not know this. Suppose I did not know this exact distribution. Suppose I was only provided sample futures, then I can decide whether or not I should be buying an umbrella today based on whether it would be useful in this future, in this future, in this future. And, you know, each future, and then basically you can then compute the expected value of buying the umbrella over these samples. And the samples themselves are following the distribution here. Which, you know, if I just give you the samples, you don't know the distribution. In our case, we know the distribution, and we are generating the samples from the distribution only because then I can do deterministic planning with them. Okay, so I would get these futures. In the most general case, they would be time-dependent futures, and they would also be uncorrelated. Those are two different issues. And then, in which case, if I do have samples, then I could have computed V star SH as max over all possible policies, all possible time-dependent policies. Okay. Notice that even when actions are actually stationary, that means their outcomes don't depend upon the time. If the horizon is finite, the policy would be non-stationary. Here, in fact, in the most general case, the actions themselves can be non-stationary. And so clearly the policy would also be non-stationary anyway. Okay. So of all the non-stationary policies, I'm computing among all of them, which of them will have the expected highest cumulative reward. If I do this, up to here, I have not done any, so up to here, what is the approximation I have done till now? In terms of doing full accurate stochastic planning, if I was actually approximating V star this way, what approximation have I done really? Not really, no. I haven't yet said that. You know, I know that in the paper you read, they've already actually went from here to time independent, correlated samples. Yes. Yeah, but that's one thing. The other thing is I'm also actually taking, so it's first of all, first thing is that I'm looking only H horizon. Right? So it's an online decision making, so it's like a game tree search where I'm only looking 15th ply. Okay, I'm always, it's possible that exactly at the 16th ply the world will change and the values that I backed up are all wrong. Okay, so that's one big approximation. The second one is not really an approximation, because if the number of samples becomes infinite, then this would actually be accurate for H horizon look ahead. So up until now, we haven't really done any approximation, okay, other than H horizon lookup. Now, what we do is, the problem, of course, right now is essentially you are looking over expected cumulative reward of each policy, and you're taking the max over all those policies to decide which is the max policy and what would be the value you get for that max policy. That's what you have to do normally. And this is where you do a sleight of hand and you just change the expectation and maximization, the order of expectation and the maximization. Okay, and the reason is mostly computational. Okay, so what you did here is, instead of doing max over all the policies and the expected value of each of the policies, you wind up doing expectation over maximum values of all the policies. Okay, now of course, remember that this is with respect to a particular deterministic future. So even though it looks like the same Bellman equation, except it is actually for an MDP which is deterministic. Okay, and so this part, what is the maximum reward you can get in a deterministic world starting from this state where you mostly get reward by reaching goal state and you get negative reward by doing actions. Okay, so here's my question. My question is, you are in a deterministic world and you are in a state S and you get some rewards to go to goal states. Each of them have some reward, they're all sync states. And every time you do an action A, you might get a negative reward of cost of A. Okay, so what I want to know is, if I start from S over and use any different policy, what is the maximum value I can get for S? That, not surprisingly, is in terms of the shortest plan to reach a goal. If you find a shortest plan to reach a goal, that corresponds to the specific policy which will give you the maximum amount of reward for S. Yes?
It's also based on the shortest path, right? But
it's
the shortest path
to
the goal with maximum reward.
Yes, yeah. So basically, if there is a single goal state and all actions have cost one, let's say, then it's just shortest path. If the actions have differential cost, then it's the shortest weighted path. Right? And if there are multiple states, it is the shortest weighted path which goes to the right goal. But ultimately, it's just optimal deterministic planning.
Okay.
do you understand what I'm saying? So we slowly went from, first of all, here itself, actually, we are talking about, you know, expectation. So we are talking about deterministic futures. But then the moment you change the expectation of the maximization, now you can actually think of this as just a planning problem. If you were to compute the optimal plan, that will tell you what is the maximum you can get in state S over all the possible policies, because that would be the one corresponds to the optimal plan that you're doing. And then you take expectation over those. Okay, for each sample you get, you know, let's say for this particular kind of future, I'm getting 25 reward. This other future, I'm getting 10 reward. This other future, I'm getting -3 reward. So now my expected reward is 25 plus 10 plus -3 divided by 3. Because each sample is equally likely. Okay, we are talking about samples. They're not weighted samples. You see what I'm saying? Okay, so that's what FF Half does. I mean, that's the theory part of it. I'm hoping that you understood this, and this is just a repetition, but that's pretty much the theory part of it. Okay? And then so the max over this is basically optimal plan, and that is computed by any deterministic planner, so it actually calls FF. Okay. Now when you call FF, you don't actually get optimal plan. You get a plan. So that's one more approximation. So the number of approximations, you started from here, first, right off the bat, you put a H, which is horizon. And, you know, you basically are saying the horizon is a fixed horizon. Okay, that's first, it's a fixed horizon look ahead. Second, you did sampling to compute the value function. That there'll be a sampling, you know, error. And the sampling error would depend on, for example, how many samples you took. Point one, and point two, whether the samples are biased. And if you have correlated futures, and if you have time-independent futures, the samples are going to be biased. Right? But this is basically like election. I mean, like when you do polling, and you're trying to figure out who's going to win the election, right? The more people you poll, the more accurate your assessment is going to be. And the more biased, less biased your polling is, the more accurate your assessment is going to be. Okay? Yes?
Is it enough to have for the sampling to be unbiased? Is it enough to have the actions have possibly different outcomes over different time steps, or do they also need to be able to have different outcomes in different
outcomes? No. See, each outcome, each action itself should have can have different outcomes in different time steps in the most general case, and different actions can have independent outcomes. They don't have to have correlated outcomes.
Right, but I mean, if you have the same action, it can be done, say, from here, like say you can do A1 and then A2 or A3 and A2.
Uh-huh. Yes, it won't. No, because that's more or less what, if I understand your question correctly, that's more or less how stochastic planning works, right? So imagine what would have really happened when you had an action A with E1 set with 0.7 probability, E2 set with 0.3 probability. When you put that action in, nature actually decides whether E1 is going to occur or E2 is going to occur. Right? And it does not decide, and that decision doesn't depend upon which state did you come to this action from. So every time you come to this action, the nature independently decides. So that's the representation. With that representation, it's not a problem. Yeah. Yeah, no, but basically think about it this way, right? So I am essentially looking ahead, you know, the same, my umbrella example, I am doing it, I'm trying to decide the use of buying, you know, utility of buying an umbrella by looking ahead for the entire next week. Okay? And And when I'm trying to decide, and you know, this basically still it is, you know, sunny, rainy, cloudy, with 0.7, 0.29, and 0.01 is, let's say, is the distribution. Okay, but for tomorrow I would decide, for tomorrow I would decide one sample, but day after tomorrow I will again compute a sample from this. Okay, and so it seems to me that the action, if you reach that action, irrespective of how you reach that action, if you're doing it on the second day, it has a certain probability. Okay. No, but okay, I mean, maybe one more thing that, let me just see, I mean, you do notice that these are strips operators. That means these E1 and E2 are doctoring over the preceding state. So if you're doing this action in a different state, you will have different outcomes, right? All I am saying is, individually inside of its own head, this action decides whether it's going to have E1 or E2, and on the second day, I have said, based on my sample, on the second day it's going to have E2. On the third day it'll again have E1, fourth day it'll have E1, fifth day it'll have E2. Now, based on the state that happened before the second day, the actual state that would be true after action A1 might be different. Okay? By the way, I mean, this is the tricky part of that paper. I mean, it's easy to understand, easy to think that you actually understood that paper to some extent, because we assume that futures are just a specific determinization of the domain. And the domain model is stochastic. You just pick one outcome for each action, you're done. It turns out that you can pick these one outcome for each action, both in a correlated way or independent way, and both in a time-dependent way and time-independent way. In the most general case, you have to be time-independent and uncorrelated. And to make your life simple, you want it to be time-independent and uncorrelated. Yes.
Just to make sure I understand, when you're choosing an action, the purpose of sampling is to figure out, given the time point in which you're choosing the action, what your kind of sample set tells you the successor state will be, right?
Yes.
That's different from choosing the maximum.
So actually, okay, let me show you this. Actually, what you are trying to do. Remember the picture, I mean, I don't know whether I should go back there or not. Remember in the LRTDP, we were making a probe until you reach the, you know, ending state. Each probe independently samples that an action. Okay? It picks, you know, it picks an action and it picks, I mean, first of all, if you're following a policy, you know which action to pick, but then it will still sample the outcomes. And the same action at different points might wind up giving you different outcomes. Okay, the same thing we are doing here, except we are not sampling the behavior, we are sampling the domain evolution itself. And then you will get a deterministic domain and you're solving it.
So that's what makes it a little more accurate with respect to what's actually going to happen than just choosing the most likely outcome.
Yes. Okay. Now, the first thing, so this is basically easy to compute. But the question is, how is this connected to this? We know this is connected to Q of S. Of course, I mean, this is the wrong number. I'll have to put a, you know, summation on, and you know, expected summation there. But V of HS is what you're computing. V star is what you really need. Okay. And the question is, how is VHS related to V star? And VHS actually overestimates V star. When I say value, think positive. When I say cost, think negative, right? So J and V, I mean, you can have MDP models with value or cost, right? We looked at it. So in fact, all this discussion is again with respect to values. That means values are negatives of cost, okay? So if VHS overestimates V star, then VHS, so the JHS underestimates J star. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you overestimate value, that's like underestimating cost. Right? The reason I say that is underestimating cost is, you should be interested in underestimating cost. Why should you be interested in underestimating cost? Because that's an admissible heuristic. Okay, so first of all, it's clear that VHS is an admissible heuristic, assuming that you do actual optimum here. If you don't, that bet is off. Okay, if you do actual optimum here, VFHS overestimates V star or underestimates the cost. To understand actually why that happens, essentially this is a very useful thing, mental picture to get into your head. What actually happens when you're doing hindsight optimization is, the agent thinks that it can pick different policies based on different futures. Okay, it acts as if basically, so it picked one policy for this future and a different policy, different optimal plan for a different future, different optimal plan for a different future. So in effect, it's acting as if it will do different actions in the same state based on which future it is in. But there is no such thing. Normally, a single agent has to essentially consider all possible futures, trade off costs and benefits, and do the best one action it can do. Okay, so that's why VHS basically gets to be much more optimistic, because it gets to choose. You know, if you happen to tell me that it's going to rain tomorrow, I will buy the, you know, the optimal action I'm supposed to do is buy the umbrella today. But if you happen to tell me that it won't rain tomorrow, then the optimal action to do is not to buy the umbrella. Okay, and I can act as if I can have it both ways. Okay, but I really have to decide whether to buy an umbrella or not based on all possible futures. And that's the reason why V of HS will essentially be overestimating the value, because it can optimize its value that it can get, you know. So it'll only have the umbrella for the days, for the futures when it rains, and it magically doesn't have the umbrella cost for the futures when it doesn't rain. But we are not, you know, we don't know futures, so we really have to pick one way or other way. Okay, so that's a very good point to understand. If you understand this, then you sort of realize why hindsight optimization is actually going to be overestimation. But then, by the way, even though I said, you know, hindsight optimization overestimates, it's not the end of the world, because actually if you think of FF replan all outcomes determinization, that also corresponds to a value function. You can call that VFFRA, which basically uses the exact same single domain model to compute the plans from each of the states. Okay? And take the total reward, total cumulative reward minus total cumulative cost, which is the total value, and give that as the value. Okay? You'll notice that FFRA overestimates VHS even, because FFRA assumes every possible outcome of the action. So, this guy assumes I am told upfront which future I am going to deal with before picking an action. This guy assumes I get to determine the future. Right, because an action A with two outcomes will become two different actions, A with E1, A with, you know, A1 with E1 and A2 with E2 as the effects. And FFRA in essence assumes I pick which action realization actually happens. That way you can get even more value. Again, all of this is assuming that you do the optimal plan. Given the actions, even if you have complete control over the world, you can still go and bump yourself on the wall, right? And I can't help you. The point is, if you do have control over the world and you have the brains to do the optimal search, then you should be able to get a plan that gives you much more value than somebody who doesn't have control over the future. And basically, the V star has the least amount of control over the future, VHS has the next least, and VFFRA has the most amount of control over the future. okay, which is why, in a sense, this is an overestimate over this, which is an overestimate over V star. And if you turn it around in terms of costs, VHS is a more or less informed heuristic than, I mean, JHS. So if I consider J star, JHS, and JFFRA, these are all heuristics, right? J functions are heuristics. So this is the perfect heuristic. Which of these is more informed than the other? HS is more informed, which is good because you're spending more time. And so at least there is some hope that it'll actually be closer to the truth. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, so that's basically the theory of FF hub. Okay, and you know, I hope you understood common random number versus correlated futures and time dependent versus time independent futures. Okay, let's see what does implementation have. What implementation basically FF basically picks, FF hub picks. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, I have one more question about
yes.
The amplifier.
Okay. Yeah.
I might wake up in the morning, but the chance that global apocalypse will happen is negligible. I won't pick it up. So you drop completely unlikely actions from the sample set.
This is in general, I mean, this is actually a perceptive question. It's a problem with all sampling approaches. Okay? Sampling approaches will miss highly unlikely events. Okay, you know, again, if you go back to your Bayes network inference methods based on sampling, the first idea you get is rejection sampling, right? Rejection sampling is you sample the entire Bayes network and see if the sample is consistent with the evidence. If not, throw it away. And if the evidence basically says, let's say that this person has Ebola, right? You know, in a Bayes network that's a generative model of people's diseases, finding a person with Ebola is a highly, highly unlikely event. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you want to say, if this person has Ebola, what is the probability that they will croak tomorrow? That's what you want to compute using your Bayes network. And you could do it exact, you could do it approximate by doing sampling. And the first idea you have is sample the Bayes network, take the sample, and see if it is consistent with the evidence, that means they have Ebola. And if they do, then you add one to the denominator. And then in that sample, if this guy is going to croak tomorrow, you add one to the numerator. Okay? And you do 10,000 of these samples, and then see what is the numerator divided by denominator is the probability for this conditional probability. Looks great. Except the throughput of samples is extremely low for Ebola, right? Because if you generate 10,000 samples, maybe you will get one sample in which the person has Ebola. And in that sample, maybe they're not going to croak tomorrow. So that means you will, using your 10,000 samples, you'll say there is zero probability that people with Ebola will croak tomorrow, which is kind of pretty off, right? Pretty high probability that they'll croak tomorrow, right? So this happened because you generated samples, you let the world behave the way it would behave. And then you went with much better ideas after that. Right? I mean, so if you remember, I mean, this is rejection sampling, and then you talk about, I forget, the other idea essentially would be allow you clamp the world to have the evidence that you want it to have, and then give it a weight. So in normal samples, each sample is worth one unit. Every sample is worth one unit. Whereas in a weighted, I forget, weighted sampling or something, I forget, what? It's not important sampling. It's called weighted sampling or something. I'll just, I mean, you go back to 471 notes, you'll see. I just forgot right now. I blanked out. Likelihood sampling, I think. Okay? I think. Again, what that idea is that it would go through the Bayes network and it would only sample the non-evidence nodes. And it will clamp the evidence node to be what the evidence currently is saying. And for doing that, it's no longer a sample, really. Right, so you have to take a hit. I mean, you have to take a nice big slap on your wrist, and the slap would be the weight of the sample. Instead of the sample being one unit, it can become 0.000001 unit. That's okay. Adding 0 to numerator and 0 to denominator is much worse than adding 0.0001 to numerator, denominator, and some either 0 or that number to the numerator. Okay, in all sampling based methods, this issue of how to deal with low likelihood outcomes becomes an important issue. Now, it depends on the query that you have in mind. Okay, if your query is conditional on, like in the Ebola case, essentially your query is conditional on evidence that's highly unlikely to begin with. So this was a problem. Now, is this a problem in planning? In general, if a particular future is highly unlikely to occur, should I care? Depends. No, but the point is, so think about this. You know, these are, at least to me, deeper questions. Maybe they're obvious to you. But why do we care about a highly unlikely future? In what?
The cost.
Exactly. Because the downside can be, you know, minus infinity. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the stock market, you know, going down by 10,000 points tomorrow is very unlikely. But if it does happen, you'll get wiped out. So if you don't sample that eventuality at all, then your entire policy is likely to be too rosy. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in fact, FFHOP has exactly that problem. And a second paper after FFHOP handled that problem essentially in an ad hoc way. You could do it a better way. Let's see, where do I show this to you? I'll get that to you in a minute. Okay, basically what FFHOP does is exactly, it adds an extra sample to take into account highly unlikely outcomes. Apart from all the samples, it adds an extra sample. Okay, what sample would you add? You asked the question, so you have to answer it. Okay, so apart from all the futures I sampled, so I'm allowed to sample, let's say, 20 futures. So I sampled 19 futures in the right way, and I get to add one extra sample to deal with these highly unlikely events. What would I do for that? I know, that's not the way. So actually, it's interesting. Think of the following thing. Even though all outcomes determinization is not a future, exactly, because each action can only have one outcome, syntactically, if I give you a sample future or if I give you all outcomes determinization, what I need to do with that domain is the same. Just feed it to FF, it'll give me the maximum value plan. So what FFHOP does is it throws in an all outcome determinization on top of sample determinization. And that is basically going to take into account if there is a possibility of reaching a goal or avoiding cataclysm with very low likelihood, it would have captured that using that. Now, of course, there's the issue of how do you combine this FFRA with the rest of the samples. That's not, you know, this is a second paper. I'll send you a link to it. But basically, that second part is not well described. It's not well founded, but it essentially, that problem, that particular approach was taken to handle exactly your question. Okay? So in general, sampling is not value sensitive. Sampling is probability sensitive. And you sometimes have to be value sensitive. And that's what happened, right? I mean, if you're not value sensitive, then you're likely to, you know, avoid futures that can be hugely negative or hugely positive for you. And then so you miss the upside as well as the downside. Okay, very good question. Okay. So anyway, so then there is, you do sampling with HRS and futures, and it sums the reward. So it actually calls FF, it gets the plans, and it sums the rewards, which is the action cost and the cumulative goal reward minus action cost. And then it takes the expectation, it takes the average to decide the V star value of each state. And once you know the V star value of the each state, then you know the Q of QS value. Not VHS value it computes, and once I compute the VHS, then I can compute the Q value of the actions, right? And then I pick the action with the highest Q value, and it picks and does that. That's what it does. Now, this is all nice theory, except what really are, you know, in actual computational cars. Okay, in terms of the computational cars. And then again, the idea that I showed you is this slide. I'll come back to this slide in a minute. Handling unlikely outcomes by throwing in all outcome determinization. That was something that was done in a follow-up paper. But there are bigger issues, which is that one of the problems is you can actually take a lot of time. I understand that you take much less time than the guy who computes the full policy and starts executing it. But you take much more time than FFRA, which just computes, you know, one future. It just assumes one future. It's a weird future where everything happens, right? Independent, and you can pick which one is going to happen. So you control the future, and then you decide what the value is. And it's going to be really, really rosy picture, but you'll get done fast. Okay. In terms of FF hindsight, basically the cost of actually action selection depends on what? The number of samples and the types of samples. If they're time independent, they're easier to handle. They're time dependent, they're a little more painful to handle. It's not really that hard. Actually, I have to check. I'm not even sure whether the implementation of FFOP may actually have used time dependent futures. It's not that hard. In terms of the code to actually handle it, because you just have to, for each level, you know, depending on the level at which the action is being considered in the search tree, you know what its outcome is. That's all. Okay. So ultimately the total amount of time you spend doesn't depend on whether it is time independent or time dependent. It depends more on how many samples you are handling. The more samples, the more work. And remember that it looks as if calling FF is coming for cheap in this way of looking at the world. But FF was solving a problem that p-space complete to begin with. So deterministic planning is a hard problem. And you suddenly are using it as a heuristic for doing stochastic planning. So here is a heuristic that's very costly to compute. So you want to reduce the computation cost of the heuristic. It's a big deal. It's not a joke, because you're talking about p-space computation, a p-space complete computation. Okay. So first of all, you can try bunches of ideas. You can reduce the number of samples. You can use the samples more wisely. For example, you can try to notice that the way you'll wind up dealing with. Suppose you're starting from S, and you can do A, in which case you can go to either S1 or S2, or you can do B, in which case you can go to S2 or S3. Okay, then basically all I really need to decide which action to pick is the values of these three guys, right? And so from each of these, I essentially compute futures, multiple futures. And in each future, compute the optimal plan, and then take the average cost of that optimal plan. Okay. One question would be, should you use the same number of samples everywhere, for example? Or should you use fewer samples in some states and more samples in other states? Right? So if you are using fewer samples, then basically, if for example, a state, if you keep track of the running average of the value of the state, okay, and after one sample, its value, with respect to one sample, let's say is 10. After two samples, it's 10.1. After three samples, it's 10.2. Then you think it's reasonable. I don't want to waste any more samples. Whereas if you have another state which has first, after one sample, its value estimate is 10. After two samples, it became -8. After three samples, it became +4. Okay, then you haven't yet reached quiescence, Where did you hear the word quiescence? 471 in game tree search. Okay, basically this is again like game tree search, where you consider certain alternatives deeper than certain other alternatives. Okay, so you would consider, for example, you could do this kind of differential amount of sampling for each state. That's another idea. Okay, a third thing is that all these states may have a lot in common, and so you should be able to reuse the work in computing the plan for this state in computing the plans for these states. That's another idea that you could use. In fact, in the second version, so this is this dynamic width and horizon for sampling. This is what I was talking about just now. You can also, and then future generation, if you do fully probabilistically, you would lose low outcome, low probability outcomes which have very high value, and so you throw in that all outcome determinization on top. Yes.
Does the number of sampling related to the length of horizon in the way that if you are trying to predict the longest horizon, you need more sampling or not?
Yeah, I believe so. There is actually a bound, a very loose bound on the number of samples mm-hmm. and accuracy in the paper. I don't remember the formula right now, but I think it depends on the horizon length, in which case it does.
Okay. And about the
but those bounds are really, really loose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's just, okay, go ahead.
And about the sense that you said, I mean, we should sample until reach kind of close variance for sample. Is it the way that we do the same, can we call it similar to the steady state situation in Monte Carlo simulation?
Sort of, I believe. I believe so. I mean, I'm not completely sure of the terminology, but I believe it's relevant. I mean, this idea of sample, again, remember that past is no predictor of future, right? You could be the unluckiest person such that after 100 samples, you thought this guy has a rock steady value of 10.785, and you take the 101st sample, after you leave, somebody takes the 101st sample, and its overall average becomes -7. right. Past is no predictor of future. Quiescence analysis doesn't tell you what is going to happen in the future. But to the extent you want to use the past as a predictor, this is basically when the estimates are stabilizing, you stop doing extra samples. Okay. Although the last few you call can change things. Yes. That's a good idea. I didn't think about it, but that's a good idea. Again, I mean, these are the kinds of things that you want to think about when you read a paper. It's not what they said, but what else can you do? I mean, I have no obvious way. I mean, it sounds like a reasonable direction. Yes, sir.
It seems like you said about, like, you could get to what you think is good, and then suddenly the next step gets really bad. So it would seem that if you get good, instead of stopping, you should start doing
Possibly. In fact, in game tree scenarios, there is this idea called secondary search, where essentially they say, in game tree scenarios, you might have, let's say, you have a min-max tree, and it's not necessarily to the same depth. Some places it's deeper, some places it's shallower. Okay. And then these are all the, and once you know the evaluations of all the lower level values, you know what is the value for the root node and what is the action to take. Now you do remember one very interesting point about min-max search, which is the value this guy has is actually values of one of these guys. Because in min-max, you don't change the leaf node values, you just filter them through mins and maxes. Right? So now you realize that you are staking your future on the correctness of this estimate. And if you have 2 extra minutes, you want to start doing an extra search underneath this. That's called secondary search. And of course, suppose you were to find in those 2 extra minutes that you're screwed, that in fact this is a really bad state. What do? Not much, it turns out. Right? Because you know, it's sometimes it's better not to know, right? Because you already decided and then you have 2 extra minutes, let me check. And then you realize that in fact it's a pretty lousy solution. So this is the point in game research, we talk about the point that horizon effect cannot be avoided. Eventually horizon effect cannot be avoided. It's easy to say that allies were stupid and that in fact Hitler was never going to stop. That's not true. You know, maybe Hitler could have stopped after one more country. Just give one more country, you know, I mean, and then he may have stopped, right? And we have enough countries. And we unnecessarily killed so many people, right? We don't know. We'll never know. Right? So anyway, that's sort of similar to your question of if you do actually stabilize, then there's, you know, then you may still, if it is critical to your decision, then you may want to do extra analysis. Now, this idea is much simpler in min-max because one of the leaf node guys can be pinpointed and say, you are the reason I have this value. In stochastic planning, you do expectations. So things get all connected up. And so you get a group of people maybe rather than just one node which actually winds up being the culprit. And so it's not as easy to do this kind of sensitivity analysis there. But it's a reasonable direction. Okay, so in terms of reuse, in fact they even tried this. So for example, you know, so there's theory and there's practice. Theory, you just try to show what are the bounds, etc. In practice, you want to win the competition. Do you see what I'm saying? And if you're trying to win the competition, I mean, do better than other people, right, then presumably one idea that they actually tried is, if in multiple samples a particular prefix is common, then you can sort of assume that that's the most likely prefix and just go ahead and do all those 4 actions and then look at what the state is and then start doing hindsight sampling again. They tried that. And I'll send you this link to the second paper where they tried a bunch of these interesting you know, little improvements. And it did improve significantly the performance. Okay, the theory doesn't change, but the practice can change quite significantly. Okay. So that's about FFHOP, and what I want to do is shift gears and at least start talking about the other part, which I may have to do a little bit of next class, but you know, let's do that anyway. So what FFHOP is doing is doing determinizations on the futures, to compute so that it can then use deterministic planning technology to solve a stochastic planning problem. But FFHOP, if you remember from, you know, a couple of days back, FFHOP is essentially an online decision maker. An alternative is an offline decision maker which computes the full policy and then starts executing it. Now, it turns out the idea of determinations is equally useful for even somebody who computes the full policy upfront. Why? Because you can initialize the V0, which is the zeroth level value function, with either VFFRA or VHS or something like that. And then you would do much fewer iterations. And in fact, the other paper, Goth, that I mentioned, essentially it does that. You know, does that with one little extra point that I'll mention in a minute, but essentially it up, you know, it initializes the original V0 with a more informed heuristic. And if you have more informed estimate of values of all the states, then when you do value iteration, you can converge much faster. And so they actually show that by doing this, they converge faster. Now, how do you initialize the values? Initialization of the values normally is done by relaxing the problem, essentially. Now the interesting thing is when you think of stochastic planning, the most obvious relaxation you can think of is relaxed uncertainty. But really I want you to think of the fact that there are 2 dimensions on which you can relax stochastic planning problems. You can relax the uncertainty, you can relax the negative interactions. You can do one or both. Okay? And so based on how much you relax, you can wind up having different, for example, different ways of initializing the value, zeroth value function. Okay? So we can relax again two different dimensions, relax negative interactions. So consider positive interactions alone in using relaxed planning graphs. That's what you would do. Just a second. And then you can relax uncertainty where you get a determinization and you actually solve it fully. That means you took both positive and negative interactions within that determinization. That would be calling FF instead of FF relaxed plan. Okay, it's not obvious when you start upfront whether doing FF relaxed plan or FF is better in overall speed. Because remember we have this, you know, depressing picture. I'll get to the raised hand in a minute. There is this depressing picture which I removed because it's too depressing, but I'll put it back again. Well, I just don't want to show it too many times, but it's worth showing anyway. Remember, this is the picture for heuristics, okay? This is the cost of computing the heuristic. This is the total amount of search effort you did with respect to that heuristic. And what you want to minimize is the sum, which is summation of these two curves. And the million-dollar question is, where is this occurring? Okay, upfront you don't know. So if you were beginning in stochastic planning, it's not obvious that doing FF replan heuristic, which will obviously be cheaper to compute than normal FF heuristic, which does full planning, which is better, which is going to have a lower cumulative cost. It's not obvious. So one of the things that Goth paper points out is, at least in the problems that they played with, using FF directly, which is a costlier heuristic, turns out to pay for its way, and pay its way essentially, because it gives more improvements overall, even if you take into account the cost of computation of the heuristic. Okay, compared to FF relaxed. Now, in this case, when I drew this picture, this is, I took one single determinization, and decided to either ignore both negative interactions or keep negative interactions. If I ignore negative interactions, I would be doing relaxed plan. If I keep negative interactions, I'll be doing FF. Now, I did say that you don't have to relax. These two different relaxations are different, right? So one issue is, what if I don't relax uncertainty? If I don't relax uncertainty and I don't relax negative interactions, then I just have normal stochastic planning. But one interesting sub-problem is, what if I relax negative interactions but don't relax uncertainty? That means I need a relaxed plan heuristic which works on multiple futures. So it's almost as if you compute multiple planning graphs, one for each future. And these futures have a lot in common. And so, in fact, you should be able to compute the planning graphs in such a way, that you could have one structure and you provide labels. I mean, again, this stuff we'll come back to next week in a different context. You can provide two labels on the vertices and edges, telling us in which world that part of the planning graph is actually going to be present. So when I'm given a particular world, so I'll give you a structure which is not only planning graph with labels. Labels correspond to arbitrary propositional formulas made up of futures. Okay? And then if I tell you that a particular future occurs, that corresponds to a particular formula, that being true. Then you intersect that with the labels, you will get the real planning graph. And then you can compute the relaxed plan over that, for example. Okay, now it turns out that idea is actually being used. It's called MCLUG, which is Monte Carlo labeled uncertainty graph. Okay, where Monte Carlo being different futures, and each future has a label, and then you consider a single planning graph over all these futures. Rather than write n planning graphs for n futures, you write one planning graph where the common parts between futures, basically you don't have to repeat them because you just write different labels for them. And these labels correspond to propositional logic formulas, and they can be pretty complicated formulas, and you write them as BDDs. Okay, that's what MCLUG does. Okay, and that idea, we'll talk about MCLUG next class onwards, an idea like MCLUG next class onwards when we start talking about partial observability, because you know this idea of labeled uncertainty graphs first came from in partial observability case, and then it also extended to stochastic planning. All I'm trying to say is that idea is a different way of doing relaxation, where you consider multiple futures at the same time, so you are not removing uncertainty, but you are relaxing negative interactions, because relaxed plan analysis means negative interactions are gone. Okay, and I don't know whether that would be better or worse than a single determinization, do the best you can with it. So you pick one determinization and then do the optimal planning with it, versus you pick multiple determinations corresponding to multiple possible futures, but do combined analysis, which is not necessarily the best for any single future, but it takes into account all the futures. Which one is better? I don't know. That's a, you know, an area worth looking into. Okay? And then, so here is a picture that I want you to keep in mind, which basically sort of is the current state of the art in this little area on stochastic planning, improving stochastic planning using deterministic planning techniques. Okay? So first, the problem. You can do offline policy construction or online action selection. Okay, this is kind of more like what FFOP does. This is what like either MGPT or GOTS do. Okay, the second, number of determinizations used. You can use a single determinization or you can use multiple determinizations. If you use single determinization, that means you completely relaxed uncertainty in that particular case. If you do multiple, that means you allow some amount of uncertainty, basically. Okay, equal to the sampling width. Then the value, the way you represent the value function, I mean, the way you estimate the value function over these determinations. You can do relax, HF relax. If you have, for example, single determinization, I can just compute relax plan over that determinization. That'll give me either the V0 or the total plan length. Both, you know, it is useful both for people who do this and people who do this. That's my point. You need this for either of them. Okay? So you can do HFF, which is just relaxed plan computation. You can do FF, which takes a single determinization and it does the maximum analysis on it. That means take both negative and positive interactions into account. You can do MECLOG, which I just mentioned, which basically takes multiple determinizations but sort of ignores the negative interactions. So it sort of generalizes the relaxed plan analysis over multiple futures. These three already exist. There can be others that can be existing. Okay, and then finally, the way the estimates are combined to actually compute the value function or the action selection. Okay, in one idea is use something like hindsight optimization, where you are doing online decision making, where you pick one action, you know, based on the Q values of all the actions from this state. The other idea is use all this computation just to initialize the V0 and then call LRTDP or value iteration or policy iteration or some classical MDP algorithm. Okay, now the interesting thing is any path here is a planner. Some paths correspond to realize a planner. There are other paths that don't yet correspond to any realized planner. So if you haven't yet picked a plan, you know, project for this class, you know, you can pick one of those paths. Okay? And then the last thing, I'll mention it and we'll again repeat it next class, is because most of these heuristics are going to take a lot of time to compute, okay, in particular, you know, the FF heuristic is costlier. MECLOG heuristic probably may be a little on this side of FF. And something like a limited width stochastic planning, where you take an action with 5 possible outcomes and make it only have 2 possible outcomes. That's limited width stochastic planning. And that could basically also be a relaxation of the original problem. Okay, and that would be even costlier heuristic. And each of these heuristics, because they're so costly, if you every time you call the heuristic function, you're spending a lot of time. And you want to try and avoid calling the heuristic function. I mean, the maximum number of times you have to call the heuristic function is equal to the number of states. You want to do less than that. Okay, so the question of course is how can you do that, and it turns out, let me show this to you, and basically this is great advantage of knowing what the state contains. Okay, if you know what the state contains, if you have factored representation for a state, then it turns out you can actually use the plan in more places than just the problem that you solved. Okay, I'll repeat this next time, but I just want to leave this with you once. Suppose you had just atomic representation, and suppose you had S0, A0, S1, A1, S2, A2, etc., AN gives SG. That's the plan I computed for the problem S0 to SG. Last class I already told you that if you did compute this plan, then you not only know what is the right thing to do in S0 and what is the plan length from S0, you also know what's the right thing to do with S1, S2, S3, etc. To the extent Bellman optimality principle holds, right? If this is indeed the optimal plan from S0, then those suffixes must be the optimal plans from those states. So in computing this plan, you computed the values for all these guys under the same deterministic assumptions. So you already know that a plan can be used in more than one place. But suppose I want to do more than that. This is already, I got like, instead of just in solving one state's plan, I got n states plans. But suppose I want to do some n cube states plans in solving one plan, one states plan. That too is possible. Basically, if you have states and actions in factored representation, where the state is, let's say, S0 is P1, etc. up to Pn. They're all true, let's say, in the S0. Suppose you made the plan, and you finally figured out that this plan really only depends upon P1 and P7 being true. Nothing else matters. Then really, if in any state where P1 and P7 is true, this plan works. Suppose I have 10 state variables for the state. And if I only say that P1 and P7 is true, this is the plan, then that corresponds to 2 power 8 states. Now, people from logic think, yeah, this is obvious. I mean, people who use, you know, factored representations think, yeah, that's how we do life. That's exactly what we do, you know, like, you know, if you don't, for example, this is the idea, right? You know, one day I'm wearing red shirt, green pants, yellow shoes, and I was in a car, and I was in an accident. Now I want to learn from this accident. What is the maximum I can learn if I don't have any structure of the state? Don't repeat exact same thing ever again. So don't ever drive the car on today with red shirt, green pants, yellow shoes. Useless piece of information. It'll never work again because I will never again live today. Whereas if in fact one of the other things is red shirt, yellow pant, blah, 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 and a glass of vodka and blah, 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 right? So now if I learn actually why this plan, you know, why I got the accident and I realize that the vodka has given me too much happiness and I got into an accident, now all I need to do is don't drive when you drink vodka. That still leaves drinking whiskey, rum, etc. Okay? You still have to learn that in a different day. Okay, but at least you could avoid all the vodka driving. And you could do it, believe it or not, because you realize that the state is not a black box. It is made up of structured variables with valuation. This is, if you are a logic guy, you're thinking, why are you wasting my time? And if you are a, you know, atomic state guy, you think, really? Wow, I can learn so much from the state. Okay, and the Goth paper essentially is teaching the MDP guys who are in atomic state and so don't quite realize that you can do this kind of explanation based analysis and, you know, and realize that the plan works in many more cases than you actually made it for. And it's just basically using that to reduce the number of calls to the heuristic. That's it. Okay. And that, it turns out, as simple as that idea is, it's, you know, it's a useful thing because here is a costly, you know, costly computation and you avoid calling it for 2 power 8 states now. And maybe the next state, remember you already know that when you had a plan, this plan works for S0, let's say S0, really the reason it works in S0 is P1 and P7, then it works in every other state with P1 and P7. And similarly, I can figure out why does this rest of the plan work from S1 and that will tell me which part of S1 matters, and whenever those things are holding, this rest of this plan works. You can do the same thing for failure analysis. Okay? And the question, final question is, how do you explain a plan? Why do you think that vodka caused my accident and not anything else? That depends on domain theory. Okay? And in this kind of scenarios, if I have a plan, I should be able to prove its correctness. In the beginning of the semester, I told you there are three ways of proving the correctness of a plan. Regression-based, progression-based, causal proof-based. Since you already made the plan in the progression way, you can prove its correctness using regression that will sort of compute. If it's a line plan, it will compute the weakest preconditions that must hold here, 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 here for the rest of the plan to work. That would basically, once I compute a proof as to why this is correct, and anything that doesn't take part in that proof is irrelevant. Okay? Explanation is a proof, and the proof depends on domain theory. For planning, domain theory is actions and their effects on their preconditions and what makes a plan correct. So really what you do is explanation of correctness. Using regression, if it is a line plan, you can use causal proof if you have a partially ordered plan. Once you do that, you are now able to generalize the correctness of the plan so that you realize it works for many more states than the ones that you have made it work for. And this is a classic example of deductive learning, explanation-based learning. Okay? So we will stop here, and this is sort of, this makes you think about the advantages of factored representations, right? Because the work that you did could not have been generalized if you are in this situation. There's nothing you could do. Okay? We'll stop here. Next time, I will probably, if there's any additional questions on this, I'll talk about that. But then we'll mostly move, most likely, into partial observability. Okay? Which will get us to the dreaded partially observable Markov addition processes that I would like to push as far as possible. But, you know, so first we will talk about non-deterministic partial observability, which is easier to deal with. And PalmDBs we will also deal with, which is essentially, and you will be seeing that the PalmDBs can be compiled into PalmDBs, the fully observable MDBs, except with continuous state variables. Okay? Yes, sir. Not next week, no, because I'm here. Midterm is when I'm not here, so.